Thank you very much. I'm much impressed that so many of you will turn out at this time in the morning to learn about quantum physics. I need a calibration point here. Obviously, as Cambridge alumni, you're all incredibly well-educated, well-read, and intelligent. But just for my reference, how many of you took natural sciences? Oh, dear. Okay. And how many of you can still remember your quantum physics? Right? How many are working on superstring theory? Good. Okay. Oh, dear. This has already been moved. Right. Hang on a second. Could we have the slides up, please? Nope, that's not it. That's it. Okay, so I shall be talking about the LHC project. This has been in the news quite a bit in the last year, both for the great successes in September 2008 and also the great disasters in September 2008. And I'll tell you a little bit about both. I hope I won't patronise you by starting at the beginning with atoms and going down to quarks, then talking a bit about the project, and then about... It's impossible to cover all the physics topics. I have a whole bookshelf of manuals on physics topics that can be done at the LHC. So I'm going to focus on a couple of things that we've been doing in Cambridge to do with extra space dimensions. So the subtitles are the building blocks of nature, what we know, what we don't know, and how we're going to find out. So we'll start with atoms. You all know, I'm sure, Avogadro's number. How big are atoms? Well, there's 10 to the 22 odd in a gram of silicon. If you turn that into a line, there's 10 million across the head of a pin. And that means they're about 10 to the minus 10 meters across. But why are they that size? What holds them together and makes them 10 to the minus 10 meters across? Now, this is, of course, the electromagnetic force. It's holding the electrons in orbit around the nucleus. No surprise there. And the force is exchanged by virtual photons. This is what we say in the jargon. Now, particle physics is all about not just what is stuff made of, but how is it put together, what holds it together, what sets the numbers, what sets the scales. And what we see in the atom immediately is that the size of the atom is set not by a property of the electron or the proton, but by the electromagnetic field that holds the two together. Okay? And the force that holds the electron in orbit here is generated by what we call virtual photons. So those are ripples in the electromagnetic field. Now, a lot of people at this point say, how can you generate an attractive force by firing particles outwards? Right? It's going to knock the thing away, right? It's not going to pull it together. And surely this violates conservation of energy because the nucleus in the center here is somehow radiating photons in all directions all the time, and that must dissipate energy, so it can't be right. So this concept sometimes baffles people. Since you all did natural sciences, I'm sure you're happy with it. But if you're not, I'll do a demo with a piece of hose pipe. Would you like that?
Yes.
Okay, good. I shall need a volunteer from the audience, and you, young man, chose the wrong seat. You just hang on to that end and pull when I say pull. Go down there. Bit further. It's quite a long hose pipe. Not so we knock the computer off, though. Right, that'll do. Get a good grip. Okay? So, what you think of as the photon travelling away from the nucleus looks like that. And it does indeed take energy. I put some energy in, pull a bit harder, and the wave goes that way. Okay, so that is dissipating energy, and if I wanted to, if the hosepipe was infinitely long like space, then the energy would travel off forever. And it would take a continuous input of energy to oscillate the charge and keep the wave going. Okay? But there's a second wave that we can have because we've got a man on the other end. We've got two particles. He can be the positive one. And we can set up a wave like this. Okay? Now, this is a standing wave, and therefore it doesn't dissipate any energy other than the friction. Yeah? And that will sit there forever. It's a coupled system between the field and the two particles, and it can only exist because we have the two particles, one at each end. Which way are you feeling the force? Yeah. There's a tension in the pipe, obviously, and in the field, similarly, if you set up a standing wave mode, you can work out what the energy is and what the effect is of changing the distance, and what you get, in some cases, is an attractive force. So we can create an attractive force by the exchange of particles without dissipating energy, without radiating things in all directions and requiring them to turn around and come back again, because this mode is only possible with two ends. Okay? A round of applause for my glamorous assistant. Okay. The next demo I wanted, which was to break a nucleus in the room, wasn't allowed by health and safety. Okay, so if we go on inwards, to discover the electron, this was done by J.J. Thompson at the Cavendish Laboratory. There's a picture of J.J. up there with his glass tube, and this is a replica that we made for the centenary of the discovery of the electron. This was the first subatomic particle to be isolated, and this was really the first particle accelerator. Electrons emerged from a cathode at this end under the influence of an accelerating field caused by these two electrodes here, and then he had deflector plates and a magnetic field to study the properties of the particles he had. And he needed just about 13 volts to get them out. That's the ionization potential for hydrogen. And so he was working at energies of between 10 and 100 electron volts, and the corresponding temperature is about 120,000 Kelvin. So having stripped the electrons off the atom, you get to the nucleus, you say, how big's that? And it won't be any surprise to see that this is quite small. So if we blow this atom up to the size of the Millennium Dome, and we ask ourselves, how big is the nucleus now? Let's have a guess, a bit more audience participation. Size of a mini, anybody? Football? Grain of sand? Speck of dust? Football. The grain of sand majority was right. It's 3 millimetres across. So atoms are 99.99999% empty space, which is a bit odd because, you know, you can lean on the table and you don't fall over. But there's nothing there holding you up. It's all... You should be shooting down through your seats. It's all empty space. There's this teeny-weeny little nucleus in the middle. If you want to imagine what an atom really looks like, imagine the centre of the Millennium Dome. You've got a couple of grains of salt, and flying around somewhere in the dome is a mosquito. That's a much better picture than all these billiard balls and footballs that you see. So it's all empty space, and it's held up by the fields in between. It's the strength of the electromagnetic force that stops me from pushing those electrons away. And it's all to do with interactions of fields. It's nothing to do with lumps of matter. Okay, so we got into the nucleus, also at the Cavendish, Cockcroft and Wharton, 1932, just down the road from here, using a machine. You see these great big spheres, as beloved of science fiction movies and horror movies. And this is the accelerating tube, same principle as JJ. You have electrodes here which you charge up, and as the particles come through, you make sure that the force is always attractive. They travel down the tube and bombard the nucleus, and you find protons and neutrons inside. Now at a scale of 10 to the minus 15 meters, 800 kilo electron volts, they used 800,000 volts accelerating potential, and a temperature corresponding to about 10 to the 10 Kelvin. So what on earth holds that together? If you work out the force between two protons, separated by 10 to the minus 15 meters, it comes out about a quarter of a ton. So something as strong as the Coulomb force is holding them in there. And the answer is, it's what we call the strong nuclear force. And we now know, although we didn't when this was done, that this is caused by the exchange of gluons, which are ripples in the nuclear force field. So there's a second force in the game, which is the nuclear force field. And the size of the nucleus is set simply by the strength of that strong nuclear force. If it was a bit weaker, the nucleus would be bigger. If it was a bit stronger, it'd be smaller. The electrons aren't in the nucleus because they don't feel the strong force. So all the stuff that feels the strong force is heaved into this little knot in the centre, and the stuff that doesn't flies around the outside. So electrons go around the outside, feeling only the electromagnetic force, and neutrinos, which see neither, fly off into space. And there is a third force in the game, the weak nuclear force. This is the philosopher's stone. It can transmute one element into another. So, for example, if you put an electron next to a proton with the corresponding piece of hosepipe, in this case the hosepipe is the weak interaction, it can transfer the charge from... I really need a better laser pointer. Hang on a second. It can transfer the charge...
Better?
Yeah. From the electron to the proton and neutralize it, turns it into a neutron, and the electron is left as a neutrino and it disappears. So this can change the type of an atom. It allows hydrogen to burn into helium in the sun. The reaction, there are two of these protons converted to neutrons, and then they bind up by the strong force with two protons and form helium. And that is responsible for this burning ball of gas that keeps us all going. Now, if you want to investigate further, you have to go to higher energies and higher voltages, and very high voltages tend to break things, which is why you see these smooth, shiny spheres in all the apparatus, because a tiny dot of dust or a little sharp edge, and you will get a discharge, and you'll be banned by health and safety forever. So you go to a circular accelerator. This is the 11-inch cyclotron, which was the first one to get above a million electron volts. Very simple idea. You apply a magnetic field so that the particle goes around in a circle, and every time it crosses this gap, you switch the voltage so that it's always accelerating. And so it spirals gradually out, and you don't have to apply much. You can apply whatever voltage you like, and it will give it a kick every time it goes round. And so it will gradually spiral up in energy, and you can reach whatever high energy you like, set really by the size of the apparatus and the strength of the magnetic field it's turning in, with whatever voltage you care to use. You just have to wait longer for it to accelerate up. And since the things are travelling at the speed of light, you get a lot of hits as it goes round, so it's really quite easy to wind the thing up to high energy. The trick, actually, is not to reach high energy. The trick is to have a significant number of particles still in your beam when you get to high energy. That's much harder to achieve. This one, actually, no, sadly not. The US. But I will point out all the Cambridge things as we go along. So if you go to those sort of accelerators, any sort of circular accelerator, for example, the superproton synchrotron that was built at CERN, you can reach energies of distances of 10 to the minus 17 meters, energies of 100 gigaelectron volts, and you can look inside the proton and neutron. And what you find are quarks. Protons and neutrons are each made up of three quarks. Proton has two up quarks and one down quark with these electrical charges, which nicely make the proton charge. And the neutron has one up quark and two down quarks. And they're held together by the same gluons that we saw holding the nucleus together. In fact, the force that was holding the protons and neutrons into the nucleus, overwhelming the Coulomb repulsion that would blow them apart, is actually just the leakage of the gluon field outside of the proton and neutron. The real strong force is going on inside between the quarks. And so we see that the fuzzy ball at the center that's making up our little 3-millimeter nucleus actually doesn't have anything in it either. The protons and neutrons are made entirely of these fields, and if you try and inspect the size of the quarks, we've got down to 10 to the minus 19 meters, and we see no size at all. So what we have is this apparently solid matter is made entirely out of fuzzy fields with little knots in them, and the knots appear to have no size at all. Yeah? And the system is all coupled together by the fields. You can't isolate a quark from the gluon field. It can't be done. You can't isolate an electron from the electromagnetic field. They all sit together in one big coupled system, and that's why matter appears to be the way it is. And we're now up to temperatures, incidentally, 10 to the 17 Kelvin. The strong force gave us quite a problem in the 60s. You may remember that there was a period when we seemed to be discovering a fundamental particle every week, because you can put three quarks into a proton, but you can also make other things, neutrons and other three-quark systems called baryons. So we got that lot. And you can put a quark with an antiquark, which is antimatter. We make that all the time. And you can have a neutral system effectively by neutralizing the force between them. And that makes things called mesons, of which the lightest are the pions. And we got a bunch of those. And, of course, since these are bound systems, they can have rotations and vibrations and excitations of all sorts, so you get... And at that point, the concept of fundamental particles started to look a bit shaky. But now we understand that they're actually made of quarks, we see that the system is very simple. Honestly. we have this. This is the new periodic table of the elements. There are three families, all the same, other than their mass, and each family has two quarks in, so the normal matter is made of the up and down quark, makes the protons and neutrons, and two what we call leptons, one charged, the electron, and one uncharged, the neutrino. And then there are three copies of this. The next two quarks are called charm and strange, and the next two are top and bottom. The nomenclature is pretty feeble in particle physics. And then there is a heavy version of the electron called a muon, and a heavy version of that again called the tau. But those are all the particles we've got. What's more, the weak force, remember, could change things from one type to another, so it has got rid of these heavy guys. They were created in vast numbers in the early universe, but because of the weak force, they don't live for very long, and so they decay downwards to the lighter ones, like this, and you end up with just the neutrinos, which don't seem to decay to anything, and the three particles that we find in our normal matter. But this appears to be the complete set. We've measured the number of neutrinos. We know there are no more than three light neutrinos. And so it does seem that the pattern stops at that point, although, of course, we will be looking to see to confirm that. But at the moment, that seems to be a complete package. And those are the particles which make up the standard model of particle physics at the moment. They represent our current understanding of what are the most fundamental particles in nature, and the forces between them are the other component of the standard model, because you can't have one without the other. And there's one infamous missing particle, the Higgs. And this is predicted. In fact, it's an essential component of the standard model, but it's the only piece that we haven't yet found. Now, why is it so essential? Well, the reason it's essential is that if we work the equations for how one of these particles should behave, you discover that everything works perfectly. You can have the forces working nicely, the particles all behaving themselves, as long as every single particle in the system is massless, has no mass at all. Now, observationally, one detects that there is, in fact, some mass. The diet industry wouldn't manage without it. So there's something wrong there, and the theorists really struggled for a long time, order of 20 years, to understand how you could possibly put a mass into the standard model without breaking it. Because we don't accept just saying, oh, here's an electron, I'm going to say its mass is this, it's a fundamental constant, and I'm going to write it in a book. We want an explanation of why it's that mass and why the other particles are different masses. And it can be done. It's done by a process called symmetry breaking, and it relies on the Higgs boson. And the Higgs is another field in the vacuum, which exists apparently throughout all space, and it has ripples, just like the hose pipe, floating around. And this is a simulation of what a quantum vacuum would look like. You tend to think of the vacuum as empty, but the uncertainty principle doesn't allow the vacuum to be empty. Things bubble out of the vacuum and disappear again and annihilate. And if you plot the field strength as a function of time in the quantum vacuum, it does that sort of thing. It looks like a lava lamp. And particles flowing through this are interacting with all the fields around them via the set of interactions they're allowed. So the electrons are feeling the electromagnetic force, but not the strong force. Neutrinos are feeling the weak force, but not the electromagnetic force. And all of the particles which have masses apparently feel the Higgs field. And it's swimming through this Higgs field, like treacle, that gives them their masses. And their strength of their interaction to the Higgs field gives them their different masses. Okay, so that's the textbook explanation, which may possibly be correct. I'm an experimentalist. You may have deduced that by now. So our job is to go out and prove whether this is right or wrong. Just because every theorist in the world tells you that the idea is right, you shouldn't take that seriously at all. You should, in fact, be even more determined to prove them all wrong. So where we stand with the Higgs is that at the last accelerator, LEP, there were some inconclusive hints that they had a signal at 114 GeV, and the machine was run for a little bit longer, and it didn't get confirmed. So what we know, though, is that if you run the theory without the Higgs, and you allow the energy to rise to 1 tera electron volt, then the theory breaks. The equations become nonsense, you predict infinities and things, and you know it's wrong. If you put the Higgs in, you can get up to 1 tera electron volt as long as the Higgs mass is below that, because we know some of the masses of the particles, and the Higgs has to give them those masses. So you can't give the Higgs an arbitrarily large mass. If you give it an arbitrarily large mass, it has a very small effect on everything else. And we know how big its effect is supposed to be, so it's pinned down into a quite a narrow mass range between roughly 100 GeV and 1,000 GeV. The LHC is designed to hit the 1,000 GeV mass range and see if there's anything there. So we can eliminate the Higgs hypothesis or find it, one or the other. I don't much mind which, although I have a personal preference for not finding it. But either way, someone's going to get a Nobel Prize, so that's okay. Now, if you listen to people, you might think the standard model's perfect. It explains all the data we have. It makes a nice little tight set of particles and forces that all work together, and it has one thing left to find. So it sounds like this should be an easy job, and we can wrap up and go home. But there are actually quite a few things that are wrong with it, which may make you more skeptical when you're told that the theorists actually understand what they're doing. So why are there these three families of quarks and leptons? Nobody ordered three. We only need one to make everything we've got. So what are the others doing there? And since the set seems to stop at three, why three? Why not four or infinity? You know, actually, it's quite easy to do one, and it's quite easy to do infinity. But any number in between is quite hard to get. Right? You have to get a three out of somewhere. That's not easy. Why are there four forces? We would love to unify them into a single grand unified theory. And we have quite a good track record there. Maxwell, again a Cambridge man, although the Scots seem to think they had something to do with him. He was the first Cavendish professor, and he unified the phenomena of electricity and magnetism into the electromagnetic field. That was one huge unification. Until we did that, electricity and magnetism were parlor tricks. You could lift up something with a magnet and you could make some bright sparks, but that was about it. Once you knew that it was an electromagnetic field that was one thing, you can do radio, you can do mobile phones, you can do all sorts of fancy stuff and chips and computers and so on. That all relies on understanding the electromagnetic field. And since then, we've unified the electromagnetic force with the weak force. In the standard model, they're actually two parts of the same thing. So we've got quite a long way, and we have a fairly good idea what to do with the strong force. We have no idea at all, sadly, what to do with gravity, which I shall come back to. The forces seem to be very tightly related to the particles. In fact, the harder you look, the harder it is to find any particles. There's these infinitely small dots which seem to be some sort of source of the field, but there doesn't seem to be any extended object down there. Is there some fundamental connection between the force carriers, the photons, the W and Z of the weak force, the gluons of the strong force? Are they connected in some way with the matter particles in a neat way? Because they're not in the standard model. And there are models relying on something called supersymmetry, which attempt to do this, but they don't seem to work that well just yet. Why do particles have mass? We've talked about that. The standard answer is the Higgs boson, but if you don't find it, you've got to come up with another answer to that question, and that is a very, very basic question in particle physics. And the one I shall concentrate on at the end of the lecture is, are there only three space dimensions? It seems reasonably obvious. If you try to fall down, you can fall this way and you can fall that way, and, you know, but there's only seems to be three ways to go. But in modern physics, we don't allow simple things like that to deter us. So there are good reasons for suspecting there might be more than three space dimensions, and there are good measurements you can do to test whether it's true. If it was pure speculation, I wouldn't be interested, but because there is a measurement that I can make to tell you the number of space dimensions, then I want to go out there and make it. Okay, and the other thing is the standard model breaks down at an energy of 1 TeV. Even with the Higgs in, it becomes uncomfortable, because you need to set particular constants to values to 16 decimal places in order to make it work. And that's telling us that there's something else beyond the standard model which ties it together and answers hopefully some of these questions. So that's what we'd like to know. Okay, so now that brings me to the Large Hadron Collider. This is a 14 tera-electron volt proton collider. That doesn't actually give you 14 tera-electron volts of usable energy, because you only get two of the quarks, one out of each proton. But it gets you well above one tera-electron volt, which is where you want to be. It's built in the old LEP tunnel, which is 27 kilometers round, which is roughly the size of the Circle Line, if you want to get some feel for the thing that we're doing. It's the largest single machine that's ever been built. It will generate 40 million collisions per second. continuously, more or less, while we're running it for years on end. The whole machine uses superconducting magnets in order to steer the particles around the bends, and they run just 2 degrees above absolute zero. They're cooled with liquid helium. And the vacuum inside the beam pipe has to contain less air than the surface of the moon, otherwise you collide with it on the way around and you lose your beams. So it's quite a technical challenge to build this thing. This is CERN, the European Particle Physics Laboratory. It's really now a world particle physics laboratory. I'll show you a map in a minute. You'll see that this has almost everybody in. This is the original CERN site here, which crosses the Swiss-French border at Geneva. Geneva's over here. This is the main runway of Geneva Airport. And that's Lake Geneva there. And there's some rather good skiing up here. This was the proton synchrotron that was built when I was still in Nappies to be the highest energy machine in the world at 28 gigaelectron volts, and it's still used as the first stage of the acceleration system. This is the superproton synchrotron at 400 gigaelectron volts, where I did my PhD. And this is the LEP tunnel, which originally ran with electrons at 200 gigaelectron volts, but now we're going to put the LHC into it and run at 14 teraelectron volts. And all of the previous accelerators are used to wind the particles up to that energy. You can't start particles off from zero and get them up to 14 teraelectron volts. It's kind of like changing gear in a car. You just can't get the accelerator to have that dynamic range. So we still reuse all the previous systems to get up to the right energy. This is what it looks like inside the tunnel. This is the end of one of the bending sections. So this is the blue one here is a big bending magnet. They're about 10 meters long. It goes off this way. And then it runs into a bunch of quadrupoles and sextupoles and octopoles and so on, which are running down to one of the experiments at the end of the straight section there. There are 1,232 main dipoles in the ring, and there are about another 6,000 or 7,000 other magnets which do the focusing and steering of the beams as they go around. All of these are superconducting, well, pretty much all of them are superconducting magnets, which require quite a lot of care and attention. At the end of the straight section, as an experiment, and the one I work on, apologies to anybody from the other collaborations who might be here, I'm only going to talk about mine, is the ATLAS collaboration. It has 2,500 scientists and engineers from 37 countries. There's a map there of our coverage of the world. As you can imagine, meetings tend to be a bit difficult. We do a lot of video conferencing, and we tend to have the Americans in the early morning and the Far East in the evening and Europe in the middle of the day kind of thing, and we all get to miss our lunch. This is one of the office buildings at CERN where we got a few hundred members of the collaboration to stand and be photographed together, but we've never had everybody in the same place. So those of you who've gone off into industry to build things or project manage or so on, this is quite a project management task. I was at the very first meeting of this collaboration before it became a collaboration when we sat down and said, what are we going to do about the LHC then? And that was in 1989, and we've been at it ever since. So what did we sketch on the blackboard? Well, what you need is a system which can identify as many as possible of the particles that fly out of the collisions. You bring your two protons in, smash, you've got lots of energy. Energy equals mass times c squared, so you make lots of massive particles which come flying out at you. Some of the exotic ones decay before they reach the detector, and what you have to do is to measure everything that comes out and try and reconstruct what happened. So we have the collision point here. Then the first segment of the detector is actually all circular, but for clarity, we've just drawn a wedge, tries to track the particles with as little disturbance to them as possible. So there's a system of detectors here. We built a chunk of this, where the particles fly through, and we have, I can never remember the exact number, it's between, if you take out the 80 million channels of pixels in the center, there's about 6 million channels of hard electronics in this bit, which registers the position of the particles as they fly through. Then you want to stop them and measure their energy, so they slam into a calorimeter, and different types of particles behave differently. Particles which only have electromagnetic interactions, like photons and electrons, shower and lose their energy rather easily. And so we have a layer of calorimeter dedicated to the ones that stop quickly, because if they stop quickly, we know that's what they were. And then we have a second layer of calorimeter here, where the strongly interacting particles which will penetrate this first thin layer will be stopped and their energy will be measured. So, for example, a proton or a neutron will make a big extended shower as it goes through, but eventually you will catch all the energy. This has to be quite deep, and this is what sets the size of the detector. You've got a teraelectron volt of energy coming at you in one particle, and you've got to stop it and contain it, and that's what takes the depth. And then finally, there are these muons, which are like heavy electrons. Because they're heavy, they don't lose energy very easily at all. So they fly straight through the calorimeters. And so on the outside of the calorimeters, we have a system of magnetic field to bend them and measure their momentum, and detector chambers to measure their positions so that we can reconstruct those as well. And anything that comes out back like that, where the momentum here is the same as the momentum here, we say is a muon. So we can distinguish the different types of particles. We also produce neutrinos, and they go flying through the detector without doing anything. They can go through light years of matter without doing anything. But we can infer their presence by the imbalance in the overall energy as long as we capture the whole collision. So we need a detector which completely surrounds the collision point. And this is the CGI of how you do it. The beams come in through the two ends. They collide at the center here. This is the tracking system which Cambridge worked on, the calorimeter, two layers, and then the magnetic field for the muon measurement is done by these huge superconducting toroids at the outside, and interleaved with all that are the muon chambers, and the big wheels on the back are the muon chambers that measure the forward directions. There are some people here for scale. This is the muon magnets in place. We have one technician here for scale in his hard hat, and you can see the calorimeter sitting there waiting to roll in. This picture went all the way around the world because it looks like Stargate. But actually, it's nothing more than a magnetic spectrometer, just a big one. Then you put the detector chambers on. So here you see the layers of chambers, and they're also interleaved into the thing there, and you see the center has been filled up with detectors in the middle. And then this was the last piece going in. Here's the main part of the detectors over here. The beam is running through in that beam pipe. And the last piece was installed by this guy. And this is the big wheel. That big wheel, which is about 25 meters across, then rolls in on its rails to close the detector at the end. The engineers were, I remember being in the meeting where we said, can we make those wheels move? It would be so much easier. And watching the engineers sort of crawl under the desks. And but after a few beers, we persuaded them to do it. So, yeah, it's kind of cool. So the detector is ready, operational, and it's waiting for beam. What we would hope to see, for example, here is a Higgs decay. So this is the sort of event that you would get in real life. The two protons have come in from the ends and collided at the center. The Higgs has been produced flying downwards towards the bottom of the detector. These are the feet here. And to balance momentum, there's a bunch of particles which are flying upwards, the blue ones, which are uninteresting, but nonetheless we reconstruct them. The Higgs decays very, very rapidly to two muons and two electrons, and we can see that here. The muons, as I said, fly through the whole detector out into the muon spectrometer at the edges, and those are these tracks here. You see them flying through. They create hits as they go through, and then they're detected out here. And from the bending in the superconducting coils here, we can measure the momentum of the track as it leaves the detector, and we can also measure it in here. We have a 2 Tesla magnetic field in the center, so we can match the momentum and say, yep, that's a particle which can travel through 5 meters of iron without losing any energy. It's a muon. And there's another one here. And then we have two particles here which go through the tracker and deposit all their energy in the first layer of the calorimeter. Those are our two electrons. So we take the measured energy and momentum of these four particles, we reassemble it, and we get back the mass of the Higgs. That does not allow you to discover the Higgs by itself, because there are all sorts of random background processes that can make something similar to this. So what you have to do is to accumulate a lot of data, and then you find that the events keep piling up at the same mass. Then you think you've got something. So the detector is powerful enough to find the Higgs, or indeed all the other new physics processes that the theorists have thrown at us, but it will take time. We're not just looking for one thing. We have a whole books full of predictions from people that we have to check out. And what you do is you start the collider and the energy will be low, the luminosity, that is the brightness of the beams will be low. So we will get rather little data to start with, and we will have to understand the detector, make sure it works properly, detect some things which we know, particles which we know and love, so that we can prove that we know what we're doing. And then we have to accumulate enough data that we can start to see these different mass peaks and so on standing out. So this will take time. So people who expect to see results immediately the machine turns on are going to be disappointed. It's like a year, I would think, before anything meaningful would be said. But it will be a fun year, nonetheless. Okay, so what happened last year? This was the counting room on the 24th of September in last year. The people sitting at the desks are actually driving the experiment, and the people standing up are members of the collaboration who had nothing else to do on that day than go and stand at the back and get in the way. And I'm proud to say that these two, Dave Robinson and Tom Barber, Dave is one of our physicists from the Cavendish, sitting in the front row actually making something useful happen, and Tom is one of our students, and he had done well enough by his second year that he was allowed to drive the thing as well. So they're actually useful people on that photograph. This is the run coordinator getting very excited as the data started to arrive. And this is the sort of thing we saw. They never got the beams colliding. They put beams in one direction and beams in the other direction, but they never had a chance to bring them into collision. But in order to check out the detectors, they did spray the beam at us from a distance. So they hit a target over here with the beam. That's called a beam splash event, and that showers thousands of particles into the detector from the side, and that allowed us to check that, in fact, we could detect things and it was working. We'd also been counting cosmic rays for some time, but cosmic rays give you one particle in all your millions of channels of electronics. So that doesn't, it does a test of sorts, but it's not the same as having everything fire at once. And this, as you can see, the detector lit up like a Christmas tree and was that you can see the particles flying through in different directions and so on. It's quite a mess because it's not designed to detect things from the side, but nonetheless, it worked. So that was very good. 10th of September. 10th of September, 10:19, we were all very happy. And about 10 days later, we weren't quite so happy. So what happened here? This is the joint between two magnets. So this is a superconducting dipole magnet. This is another one. And the cryogenics, which carries the cooling helium, has to pass from one to the other. And the electricity that drives the magnets has to pass from one to another. They run at a nominal current of 8,000 amps. And the specified resistance of the joint between the two is less than a nanoamp. Okay. In order to keep the helium cold, there's an insulating vacuum chamber here. So there should be vacuum in this region, which stops the heat flowing into the helium and boiling it. That is a disaster because if the helium boils, the superconducting cable goes normal. And now you've got 8,000 amps going through a common or garden piece of metal. Okay? So what happened here was that this, well, not this one, because the one that it happened to vaporized, but one like this developed a resistance which tests, looking at the temperature data, it seems to have been around 10 nanoohms. And this was probably because of an incorrect soldering operation. It had been tested to 6,000 amps before, and all the magnets had been tested to 8,000 amps. So the only thing left to test were the interconnects, and all the interconnects had been done except this sector. This was the last one. And they wound it up to 8,000 amps, developed this resistance of 10 nanoohms, the temperature started to go up, the helium boiled, and it went normal and vaporized. That by itself wouldn't have been a disaster because it's like blowing a fuse. We would have just replaced the cable. But an electrical arc punched a hole in that vacuum vessel just there. Okay, so now you've got the helium with heat being dumped into it, expanding, it expands by a factor of 1,000, going out into this vacuum vessel. The vacuum vessel has pressure relief valves, and they're designed for normal leaks, right? But this thing was boiling several tons of helium, okay? So a pressure wave went down the tunnel, and it hit the vacuum seals roughly 100 meters from this point. And that created a shock, which did that. So that's as they found it with the bellows, and that's the innards where the connection should be. So that was caused by the it wasn't an explosion, that was caused by the mechanical shock of the helium hitting the ends of the vacuum vessel. And it knocked several magnets off off their supports, so That whole 100-meter section had to be dismantled and rebuilt. It also contaminated the inside of the vacuum chamber, which had to be cleaned out, and so on. And all the way around the whole ring, we've been going around replacing the pressure relief valves with bigger ones, just in case it happens again. So then you could survive such an incident. It would be a couple of weeks' work to fix rather than a year. So that's what happened. It was, I think, very bad luck. It looks like it was no more than a Friday afternoon. Somebody didn't quite do the soldering right. And at the level of nano-ohms, you can't test it warm. You can't measure that resistance until you've got the thing in the machine. Right? We now have a way to test by looking at temperature data that we can see such failures coming. So it's very unlikely to happen again. But just for safety, we're going to start this time at half the normal energy, which is below 6,000 ohms, 6,000 amps, and we should be quite happy to get going that way and then crank up once we've got a bit more experience. So for the last 20 minutes, I'm going to talk a little bit more about some of the more speculative physics that we've been doing. As I said, there's hundreds of things I could talk about. I could talk about supersymmetry, or I could talk about the Higgs, I could talk about anomalous gauge forces or whatever. But I'm going to talk about extra dimensions because they're fun and funky, and we've done some work here on them. So what's the problem? Well, we'd like to understand all the forces that we have as in one unified theory. Einstein set out to do it with electromagnetism and gravity and failed. And the first mention of extra dimensions, which led to all those 1950s films with the fifth dimension in, came from a pair of physicists called Kaluza and Klein, who attempted to unify electromagnetism and gravity using an extra dimension to do it. So this is a problem that's been around for a long time, and it hasn't worked. And the reason that we haven't been able to do this is that although the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic force all seem to behave in a very similar way, and we've succeeded already in unifying the electromagnetic and weak forces, and the strong force appears to operate on the same sort of principles, that's all fine, and they all look very similar at energies above a TeV. They all seem to behave pretty similar. So we've got a path, at least, to unification of those forces. But gravity doesn't fit in at all. It's really, really weak. And you can see how weak it is, because you're sitting on your seats, right? And you're not falling towards the center of the planet. Now, there are millions of tons of matter underneath you pulling you vertically downwards. And the few atoms in your seats, the electric forces between them, are enough to hold you up against that huge tonnage of planet. So you can see that the electromagnetic force is vastly stronger per atom than the gravitational force. Gravitational force is completely negligible on quantum terms until you go to colossally high energies, which we're never going to reach. So experimentally, it's difficult to do any measurements, but theoretically, it's very hard to get a force which is orders of magnitude weaker than the others to cooperate in a unified theory. And that's been a stumbling block for at least a century. Everyone who has tried it has failed. Now, if you bash your head against a problem for long enough and you don't succeed, and some very bright people have tried this, sometimes what it's telling you is that you've missed some crucial ingredient. And quantum mechanics is an example. There were failures of classical physics, and they were only fixed when somebody came up with quantization. So maybe there's something missing. And extra dimensions is a possibility as the thing which is missing. Perhaps you could get away with unifying this thing if we could just make gravity a bit stronger. Right? So let's have a much stronger gravity, and then we'll be able to do the unification. You can't do that, obviously, just change the gravitational force with a knob, but if you have more than four space-time dimensions, I always refer to four space-time dimensions, okay, three space and one time, which are kind of mixed together in general relativity, but that's three space dimensions. If you have more than that, then the gravitational field can exist throughout the extra dimensions. And hence, when you try and measure the strength of it, you're missing the bits that are not in our three dimensions. So it's only weak because you're missing a big part of its strength. Okay? And then we can make the gravitational constant as big as we like, and that enables you to write down a theory which you have at least a chance of unifying. So this is an interesting idea. It seems obviously completely mad. And if there wasn't an experimental test, I wouldn't even bother reading the papers. But there are experimental tests. So let's just see how this works. I'm going to challenge you now with a little bit of maths. Oh, sorry, what happened there? There we are. A very, very little bit of maths. So if you have a test mass, you let the field radiate out of it, and you try and count the field strength. The field lines give you the force per unit mass, and you intersect all the field lines with a sphere. The surface area of the sphere is 4 pi r squared. That's equal to some constant, doesn't really matter what it is. And so the force drops off with r squared, the inverse square law. And that is telling you that it comes simply from the fact that the surface area of a sphere is 4 pi r squared, or more simply, that surface areas go as r squared. Yeah? That's where the inverse square law comes from. And that property of a sphere is there because it's a three-dimensional sphere. If it was a two-dimensional sphere, it would go with r, and if it was a hypersphere, it would go with r cubed. So the fact that it's the inverse square law is telling you we have three space dimensions, at which point you might think, game over, we've measured it, it went as 1 over r squared, why are they talking about this? Okay, but these guys are clever. So if you went into 5D space-time, you'd have the field lines you had before, and you'd have some, these are supposed to be coming out of the board at you. I should get Pixar to give me some of those polarized spectacles, and you could have it in 3D. Now, I've got the surface area of the sphere in my three dimensions, which gives me the r squared, and one more dimension to multiply in. So the surface area of this four-dimensional hypersphere goes as r cubed. And so I would predict a force law, which actually looks like this, and it would be the inverse cube law. And as I said, we know that's not right, so why are we worrying? In fact, we know it's not right thanks to another great Cambridge physicist, Henry Cavendish. He took an apparatus actually designed by a guy called Mitchell, and he measured the density of the Earth at Clapham Common on his own estate. He was obviously richer than me. So he had these lead spheres, and he measured the attraction between the two lead spheres. He's standing outside of the room with a telescope, so he doesn't disturb the apparatus while he's doing it. And a century later, this was turned into a measurement of the inverse square law by Sir Charles Boys. And the data is very good, very impressive. So we know very well the inverse square law for large objects like cannonballs, right? But we don't make measurements like that at distant scales of the size of an atom. You can't do it because the other forces are much too big. So that gives you a get-out clause from the fact that the inverse square law is known to be right. We know that it's right at large distances. So undeterred by the inverse square law, the theorists say, OK, at small distances it does something different. And how do you get from large to small distances? Well, instead of the extra dimensions being infinitely long, like the ones that we have, or we appear to have, OK, we say you can go in that direction to infinity. But what we want is a direction you can go which is not there, there, or there, but at right angles to all of them, OK? Hence the beyond in the title of the lecture. And that only extends over a very short distance, so it goes round in a circle. It's a curled-up dimension. For the mathematicians amongst you, it's got a periodic boundary condition rather than an infinite boundary condition. Nothing wrong with that in Einstein's equations. Perfectly allowed. So now you can set the size of that circle to anything you like. Okay? And if you set it small enough, you can evade all the measurements that we have of the force of gravity. So if I was to do a test at large distance, you can visualize it as the sphere which you're measuring the gravitational field on is bigger than the extra dimension. So all the flux which is in the extra dimensions is inside your sphere, and it never penetrates the surface and doesn't count. Whereas if I go to very short distances, in other words, I use a nice big collider and measure interactions at very, very short distances, then I will get inside the size of the extra dimensions and the field will be leaving the surface as if it was flat. As long as I'm at a distance scale which is much smaller than the radius of the extra dimensions, they will look infinite. Right? And I will get back the inverse cube law. And so the force law would look 1 over r squared at long distances, but as I come into short distances, it would deviate away and gravity would be much stronger, opening the way to unification. So that's a cute idea. And that leads us to the concept of what are called brain worlds, brains being an abbreviation for membrane. So you have, this is supposed to be a slab of four-dimensional space-time, but I've only got two dimensions to draw it on, so you'll have to excuse me for using a sort of crude blob. But inside it are x, y, and z axes. It's not supposed to be a thin sheet of in Z. It extends in all normal directions inside the block here. And it also has two, for why not two, extra dimensions at right angles to each other and at right angles to X, Y, and Z. Now, they're all orthogonal. And the hypothesis is that the standard model particles cannot leave this brain. They're fixed on the brain. And there are theoretical reasons, or at least theoretical methods you can use to do that. But gravity is the force which sets the shape of space-time. It warps space-time around stars and black holes. And space-time, even in Einstein's ordinary general relativity, is bent. Yeah? So this is just an extremely bent bit of space-time, and you would expect gravity to know about it. So gravity penetrating into this so-called bulk space is normal. It's what you'd expect. You have to come up with some construction which forces the other stuff to stay on the brain, but that can be done. And now you have this brain world embedded in a higher dimensional space. Now, that leaves the possibility you could have a second one somewhere else in the higher dimensional space, a whole other universe. And what would it look like? Well, if this thing was, you know, these curly bits were a couple of microns, right, which is perfectly inside the experimental bounds, that means that if I just rotate down this orthogonal direction you can't see by half a micron, then there's a whole nother lecture theatre of people. They've all got the same X, Y, and Z as you, and even T, but they've got a different R. And now I come back to the lecture theatre. You might have a problem if you let these things move around. If the brains are free to move in this n-dimensional space, then, of course, they might every now and then run into each other. Now, what would happen there? You've got a whole universe full of particles, okay, X, Y, and Z in all directions, and suddenly at every single point of X, Y, and Z, another bunch of particles moving at high speed comes into your volume, right? There's going to be a huge smash of particles together throughout every piece of your space-time, which would look mighty like a Big Bang. And some people, smart people in Cambridge, have come up with a model called the ekpyrotic universe, which gives you a method for setting off Big Bangs in standard cosmologies by using these multiverse scenarios with moving brains. So that's a kind of cool idea as well. It hasn't got very far on the experimental verification. Those health and safety people, you know. You can also, space-time, as I said, can be curved by gravity. It can also be warped, and this is a cool concept as well. So in this scenario, you have a very small extra dimension. It's teeny-weeny-weeny, much smaller than quarks or anything that we've measured so far. And here we are on our brain. And now I go round the half micron to the next brain like that. And my box of space, it's got the same X, Y, Z, but as I rotate round, it shrinks exponentially. The coordinate system changes exponentially. The temperature goes shooting up and you end up with a plasma or a TeV scale set of particles all floating about. And then when you rotate back again, it expands back to its normal size. And this is a warping of the metric, so-called. And that allows you to hide a lot of space in a very small place, which allows you to have very weak gravity without invoking any large extra spaces. They're all in this tiny confined dimension. And, of course, it's very cool to have a paper with the title Warp Factor. Right, so is any of this any more than speculation? How can we measure it? Well, let's take that scenario where you have a very small dimension with a brain on the other side. Okay, so it's two brains separated by a curvy dimension. If you create a disturbance on this brain, the gravitational field will oscillate around the ring, and it will have certain normal modes set by the size of the ring. And they will resonate, just like an organ pipe. So you will get a set of excitations of gravity, gravitons we call them, with different masses, and they will be evenly spaced in mass, and that spacing will tell you the size of the extra dimension. So there's nothing like a big collider to disturb the fields around it. So you smash your protons together, and they create the disturbance you need. The wave function in the extra dimension oscillates at a particular frequency and spits particles back at you with a fixed mass. And here is a simulation study we did to see whether this could be detected, and you can see that this is the background that you would get from normal processes, and you get this huge resonance when the collision mass of the quarks is equal to that needed to excite the extra dimension properly. So you can actually make measurements of these things, and that would be an extra dimension whose size is 10 to the minus 32 meters, way, way beyond anything that you can measure any other way. So it's not just speculation. When you hear people say, oh, well, these theories are nonsense because you can't ever test them, it's not always true. There are ways to get at them. And that's a nice one. Another nice one is to make some black holes. Health and safety listening. If you have very strong gravity at short distances, if you put enough mass and energy into a region smaller than the Schwarzschild radius, you will make a black hole. Now, you shouldn't worry about this, because Stephen Hawking, who's another great Cambridge physicist, has shown us that black holes evaporate by Hawking radiation, and quantum black holes evaporate in under 10 to the minus 23 of a second. So they don't have a chance to eat anything. And if that doesn't convince you, because after all, I don't trust the theorists either, we're not actually creating collisions which are unusual here. That, although they're unusual for humans to make TeV energy collisions, cosmic rays are bombarding the top of the atmosphere all the time with much higher energies. They've been doing so for 4 billion years. So they've had plenty of time to make these black holes. So there are two possibilities, really. One is you can't make black holes because all of this is nonsense, which is probably the front runner. And the other is that you can make these black holes, but as predicted by our theoretical friends, they do in fact decay, and that's why we don't see them raining down on the planet. Either one is fine as far as health and safety is concerned. So there is a very long technical report from CERN which goes into the interactions of cosmic rays with the atmosphere and the moon and pulsars and compact neutron stars and so on, and demonstrates quite conclusively that there is no way that this can be a problem. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't go look for it, because if it's right and there are unstable black holes you can make, you get two Nobel Prizes, right? You get one for discovering extra space dimensions, because these can only happen if gravity is strong, and you get one for the first observation of a black hole in the lab, right? So, you know, this is obviously the thing to do. So we've done some studies of this. This is a simulation of one of the events in the detector, and what you see are the showers of particles that it spits out as it decays, which are all at very high energy. So it goes off the scale that the graphics guys foresaw for plotting these things. So they're very visible, and they should be rather easy to either find or eliminate. So that makes it a nice thing to do. So collisions are expected in the LHC before Christmas, and physicists are hoping for some interesting things in their stockings this year. And in fact, Santa put in an appearance down the pit while we were building the detector. Thank you very much. It's been a great audience. I hope I didn't bore you too much.